You are listening to a Bible study on the book of Revelation by Pastor Lastman at Messiah Lutheran Church in Seattle, Washington.
Gracious Father, we thank you for your many blessings. Thank you for keeping us safe and sound through this night and bringing us to this new day. May you grant us your grace and spirit that we might always trust what you tell us, knowing that you will never lie to us, but you always speak the truth, and that you are quite capable and competent of doing what you promise. Bless us to that end, in the name of your Son and our Savior, Jesus. Amen. Okay, last Sunday we ended up, of course, with verse 13, where we sort of lingered for a while, looking up a lot of Bible passages, which I cannot go over again if you were not with us, but if it was taped last Sunday, and I think it was, you'll find this lesson on the webpage, Messiah's webpage, if you want to listen to that. But we talked a great deal about false teachers, false prophets, Antichrist plural, Antichrist singular, because that's the essence of, remember, the second beast. The first beast represents the secular world with all of its different nuances, politics, sociology, philosophy, all the isms, science isms, and all those things. And then the second beast is a religious beast. And so the devil uses a two-prong attack, we've said. He attacks the church from the outside, the secular, non-believing world, and he even attacks the church from the inside job of false teachers, false prophets, false Christians, false brothers, and tries to do it that way. We've not talked a great deal about the Antichrist. We might do that more and more. We said it when we talked about Daniel, and we've not talked a great deal about this. Maybe it'll be appropriate somewhere down the road, that the Lutheran confessions identify the system of the papacy as the Antichrist, the second beast, because the Roman Catholic Church especially denies justification by grace through faith and does some other things as well. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, although we did that in our Daniel study. When I'm done with chapter 13, and that might happen this morning, we'll see, I'm going to have another book it's not a book, it's a study, to suggest to you, and I'll read from it either today and or next Sunday. This is a report on the Commission on Theology and Church Relations. Some of you know it by CTCR, Commission on Theology and Church Relations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, September 1995. And the Synod in convention asked the Commission to talk about the Lutheran view of church and state, because there are other views of church and state. This is the Lutheran view of church and state. It's entitled Render Unto Caesar and Unto God, and we'll try to get this on the website in the next week or two as well, or you can go to the Missouri Synod website. And I may, you see I've got a couple of markings here, I may read from it today or next week. Because that's really what we're talking about in part, aren't we, with the two beasts? Because clearly we can tell already, and we've indicated this, that the second beast, the religious beast, the false Christian church beast, has an intimate relationship with the first beast. Matter of fact, this false Christian beast, religious beast, serves the interests of the secular beast. And so this is why this is so important. We'll talk a little bit about this. And the other thing I want to talk about, too, this can be so misunderstood. I've been, because of Revelation, we've been somewhat critical, and rightly so, of certain aspects of things in this world, including government. But that can be misunderstood because government's also what? From God. We know that. Well, isn't the church from God? Well, okay, if the church can be corrupted, the government can be. So both are from God. That would be the position of the Scriptures and the Lutheran Confessions. Both are from God, but the devil, right? And that's what we're talking about. So we'll talk more about that as we go along. Now, it just takes time to do all these things. Okay, so let's begin. Let's read verse 14. Let's start at verse 11 since it's not that bad. Let's read 11 to the end of the chapter, and then we'll start at verse 14. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. Verse 12, it exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants, remember those are non-Christians, worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people, and we alluded to the prophet Elijah in the Old Testament, Verse 14 then, and the signs that are allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. 15, and it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. 16, also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead. 17, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Okay, let's go back to verse 14. And we're going to linger at verse 14 because it's kind of important, then we'll pick up our speed. And by the signs that it allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet live. Okay, so let's look at a couple of things here. First of all, by the signs that it allowed to work, well, we talked about the signs earlier. We don't maybe know all the details and specifics, remember, but whatever this coalition will be, it's going to be impressive, isn't it? And that's what I meant by signs. It's going to be very, very impressive. People who walk by sight rather than by faith are going to be wowed and impressed and say, I think I want to be on that side. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because everybody wants a winner, right? Yeah, and of course we do too. Who wins in the end? Yeah, but see, not everybody knows that. And so they think they pick a winner and they picked a loser, right, by these two beasts. So we don't know all the details of the signs, but we know enough to know it's going to be impressive and do certain things. And it does it in the presence of the first beast, that's that secular, powerful beast. It deceives those who dwell on earth. We talked a little about this, alluded to this in the earlier verses. Remember, those who dwell on earth are non-believers, right? We alluded to the fact that true believers, the elect, cannot be deceived. We looked at Matthew chapter 24. Jesus is talking in Matthew 24 about false teachers and false prophets and false Christ. And certain things would happen. Then he says something to the effect that even deceiving or misleading the elect, if that was possible. And the implication is what? That's not possible for the elect. We talked about that. Okay, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded. Now, there's a couple of passages I do want to look at, especially, and we've alluded to this over and over again in the book of Revelation, and that is the idea of deception. Remember how many times that's come up? Yeah. Jesus says, I am the way, the... So if you don't agree with Jesus, everything is not a truth, it's a what? And that's all of Satan's kingdom. And all the agents that he uses, he tells what? Lies. And of course we know from certain historical components, even in World War II, if you're going to tell a lie, tell what? Tell a big one. That's the way of the world and evil. And evil, so it's the opposite of truth. So it's the deception is always with falsehood, lies, the opposite of the truth of God, and specifically the gospel of Jesus Christ. But let's look up a couple other verses here, if we can do this, if I've got them all written out here right. I think I do. Let's go back to chapter 12, verse 9, which is where we started this whole imagery. Remember with Satan as the dragon? And now he uses the two beasts, his agents. 12:9. By the way, for those in the early service, remember I alluded to Mother Church in chapter 12? She's depicted as a mother here giving birth to children, and Satan tries to destroy her. 12:9, if I can find it here. Where'd it go? Okay. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan, the what? Deceiver of the whole world. Now, a couple of ways to remember that, and I always want to remind you of this, are the name Satan and the name devil. Satan means adversary or enemy. So an adversary or enemy is not going to tell you the truth. He's always going to tell you a lie. And then in the Greek, the word devil, which comes from the Greek word, really means a liar. A liar. So you put those things all together, you can see why he's then called the deceiver, because it's found right in his very name of Satan and the devil. Okay, that was 12:9. Let's try 18:23. We'll go a little bit forward. And this is, of course, supplementary to what we did last week of looking at all the Bible passages about false teachers, because false teachers obviously deceive and mislead. 1823. And the light, and we'll get to this eventually, and the light of a lamp will shine in you no more, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will be heard no more. This is the Babylonian whore, the great anti-kingdom, Christ kingdom. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all the nations were deceived. And in verse 8, chapter 18, Babylon stands for the entire kingdom of Satan and his two beasts that he works through. See, and so Satan working through these two beasts deceived all the nations, which we've already heard. Let's go to 1920. Well, this is good news here. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet. Remember, the false prophet is the second beast. The second beast morphs later on into what's specifically called the false prophet, which is fitting for a religious beast. Who in the presence had done the signs which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those worshipped him. So here we see where Jesus wins in the end with that deception. Let's go to chapter 20, and we should have three references, I think and hope, in chapter 20. Chapter 20, verse 3, talking about Satan, you can see that. And threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so he might not deceive the nations any longer. We'll get to that until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Well, maybe I'll say it now so you can get it. The 1,000 years is an entire New Testament time period, remember? All these time, first coming to second coming. And we'll get there in more details, but that's the entire period. That he may not deceive the nations any longer. Well, he can deceive those who dwell on the earth, but he can't deceive you, because you know the truth in Jesus Christ. Yeah, that's what that means. So the moment Jesus Christ showed up on the scene, okay, to use eloquent theological language, Satan was dead meat. That's what that means. Because I can't contend with the truth and Jesus Christ. So he can no longer deceive. Wherever the gospel of Jesus Christ is proclaimed, right, people are delivered from the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of Satan, and they are no longer deceived. And that's what that means, and we'll do more details when we get there. Still chapter 20, verse 8. We'll do 7 and 8 maybe. 7 and 8 of chapter 20. And when the 1,000 years were ended, this is the end, towards the end of the world, Satan will be released from his prison, will come out to deceive the nations. We'll talk about that. Four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and we'll get there later. But you see, the key word there is, again, deceive. And then finally, hopefully, verse 10. Verse 10. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire, sulfur, where the beast and the second beast, the false prophet, were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Amen. Because Jesus wins in the end. But we have to walk by faith, don't we? Not by sight. And that's you know Bible passages that say that. It doesn't look like we're winning. I don't know what would be a good illustration, although it might be the Mariners. That's what I'm getting to. That's what I'm getting to. You know, if you're following the Mariners, it's Mariners are up to bat, and it's 10 to nothing. And you're about ready to go home. And they pull it out in the bottom of the ninth, win 11 to 10. I mean, obviously, it's a silly illustration. But that's what we're saying about the kingdom of the world and everything. It doesn't look like Jesus is winning. I mean, think even on the cross. Did it look like Jesus was winning on the cross? No. See? So it's the same thing today. It doesn't look like... Think how many problems the church has. False teachers and divisions and pedophile priests and this and that and corruption and, you know, and all the attacks on the church and everything else. The visible organized church often doesn't look very impressive. You know? So you might not want to put your money on the church, right? If you're going to walk by sight. That's the key. But we know the Word of God. And that's what this is why this is so important. And I think that's one of the values of the book of Revelation, even though we have a hard time understanding all the imagery and everything. It kind of puts things that are kind of cognitive, you know, sound very abstract, these ideas, and puts them in very dramatic what? Images. Like, if you won't be afraid of Satan, maybe if you see how he's described in Revelation, you will be. Right? See what I'm saying? Okay. Okay, so those were the key passages that we saw in the book of Revelation. Let's see if anything else. Oh, yeah, let's go back. I need to go back to Revelation 13, so just bear with me just a minute as I get back there. Revelation 13. Okay, telling them to make an image. Now, this idea of an image, this is a very hard concept. I haven't read every commentary in Revelation, of course, but I read a lot of commentaries, and they comment on all the commentaries that I haven't read. And this is a hard concept to come up with specifics, you know, of what this image is. Although I'm going to show you some Bible passages, and you really can't live in community of any kind without certain kinds of symbols, can you? And images, whether it's a religious one, right, or even in a secular world, every kind of secular organization, community always has some sort of what? Image or something, right? I mean, think of the Nazis in World War II or any time. The Romans, you always have some kind of image. So it's hard to tell specifically what the image will be, but there will be a clear image that symbolizes this power that is against the church. And let's look up a couple of passages that may help you just modestly with the idea of an image. I've got three for you. Let's go to Matthew 22:20. A passage you're very familiar with, but I'll sort of emphasize another aspect of it. So Matthew 22:20. Let's put a little bit in the context, start at verse 15. 22:15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. Does that sound like the unbelieving world? Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Does the world still try to do that with us in the church? You stupid Christians. You just knew science better. You just knew sociology better. Right? They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God." You know what we call that up today? Pardon my theological language again. Sucking up. Is that what they're doing? They don't believe a word Jesus says, but what are they doing? Yeah. Buttering him up, flattering him. "And you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by..." Oh, does that fit in with what I've been talking about the last 15 minutes? You're not swayed by appearances. Verse 17, "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" Now, you know this is a setup job, right? Did the Jews like the Romans? No. So if Jesus says, "No, you shouldn't," what can they then say to him? If he says, "No, you shouldn't pay the taxes," where are they immediately going to run to? Pontius Pilate, and say, "Hey, this dude's preaching not pay taxes. I think you ought to arrest him." There you go. There you go. Exactly. Exactly. So they're going to get him that way. If he says yes, then they can turn to the people and say, "Why would you follow this guy? He's saying pay taxes to our hated enemies." They're setting him up. "So is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not, this pagan government?" 18. "But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, 'Why put me to the test, you hypocrite?'" Now, he's not going to build churches talking like that, I'll tell you. Verse 10. "Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Who's what?" It's the same with the image. That's why it's an image on the coin, right? And this coin says it's minted by whom and belongs to whom? Rome. "An inscription. They said, 'Caesar's.' Then he said to them, 'Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God.' And when they heard it, they marveled." And they left him and went away. No more questions for today. Now, the main thing I want you to see is the idea, because we're talking about an image, right? Every organization, community has some kind of image. I mean, even if you live in an apartment complex or someplace, they have some sort of name and image, right? Everything is labeled. We label everything. And so this political, secular, religious, false Christian coalition is going to have some sort of image that will be identifiable in terms of its being against the state, I mean against the one true church. Now, the other thing we want to see, of course, is, and it applies to what I was saying a half hour ago or 20 minutes ago, church and state are related, but they are distinct, aren't they? This is where it began. And I'll say more about that because I think some of you might be confused what I'm saying or not saying or what the Lutheran confessions say. As I said, church and state are from God. Church and state are both from God. And they have different functions. And in that sense, they're separate. We don't run the church by law, do we? Or we shouldn't, right? Church is run by the gospel, but the state is not run by the gospel. The state is run by law. And so there is a proper thing, and I'll talk about this maybe today or next week. There is a proper distinction and a proper separation between church and state in terms of how they function. But what we'll say later on is it should not be such a profound distinction that they absolutely have nothing to do with each other at all in terms of like you expressing yourself and somebody else has brought that up. And we'll talk about that. It's just a little bit too nuanced. But here you can clearly see Jesus says, well, you live in two kingdoms. Pay your taxes and do what you're supposed to do for God. Okay, let's look at two others, though, where we have image, because I think this is the more significant passages, and they're both in Colossians. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. First one is chapter 1, 21, I hope. Colossians, is that right? Where did I get that? Colossians 1, 15. I've got to get new glasses, that's for sure. Colossians 1:15. There we go. Okay, yep, ready? This is talking about Jesus. He is the what?
The image
of the invisible God. Now, that's very important. Well, let's go to the other one. I'll tell you why this is important in the context of Revelation. Let's go to chapter 3, verse 10. And have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator. Now, here's the deal. Christians, then, have an image, don't they? The image of Christ, the image of God. And non-believers are also going to be associated with an image. Okay, and both images will be identifiable of who you belong to, which are going to be very similar and closely related to what we'll hear in a minute about the seal and the mark that we'll hear. And as a matter of fact, when we're done with chapter 13, I'm going to show you all the similarities in chapter 13 of Satan trying to imitate God. And I'll show you all those references that you may already be aware of or that you've missed. I'll either do that today or next week. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say here is with this image, Satan working through these two beasts, working in connection with each other, are trying to impose themselves and make themselves look like God. Exactly. And we'll see that. That's why that's important. Okay, let's go on then back to Revelation 13. We'll move maybe just a little bit faster now. Okay, verse 15. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the beast to be slain. Now, this is kind of another difficult passage, although it's really interesting, and I'll see if any other translation picks this up. The actual Greek word here, and it's okay to translate it breath, but the actual Greek word here that caught my attention when I was looking at it is actually the word that's commonly and mostly translated spirit. Now, you put spirit in the place of breath, that kind of gets your attention, doesn't it? Is allowed to give spirit to the image of the beast. Well, now, wait a minute. If I told you, and we'll see this in a little bit, that Satan working through these two beasts is trying to mimic God, who gives us his spirit? God, doesn't he? Through the image of Christ. And here we have the spirit given to the image. See what I mean? See, these are all these overtones. So he's allowed to give breath or the spirit to the image of the beast, so the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would worship the image to be slain. Let's do about even speak. This is a hard one, too. In the immediate context of John receiving this revelation, historically, it's kind of easy to understand and explain because we know from the writers of history and the writers of the different religions in the Roman Empire and among the Greeks and things that in order to impress people with these idols that had their own temples, they had all different kinds of tricks to fool the common man that these idols of wood and stone could actually speak or do things. I mean, they had ventriloquists, and they even had water mechanisms behind the scene that would make it look like the image was moving. That's all true. And so that fits in very well contextually with the Roman Empire and with John wrote. But it becomes a little bit more difficult then to say, well, okay, what would that mean today in a more modern setting? And it's a little more difficult to be specific, but clearly the implication is that there's supernatural powers at work that make this image, this beast, this coalition of these two things being used by Satan to be something that is viable. Right? You'd want to put your faith and trust here, right? Now, that's kind of the image and the implication that we have here. Now, it's a little bit easier to see that those who would not worship the beast to be slain. I don't know what would be a good illustration here. I'm not sure that this is the only one, but there's several that I could use. During the time of the Middle Ages, if you didn't toe the line with the papacy, what happened? Surely you know. You were killed. And the most infamous of all that, although it's not the only one, of course, was the Inquisition. And there were two Inquisitions. So here you have a Christian institution that is coalesced with a power base of politics, because that's what the medieval papacy was all about. We'll maybe talk about that later. That's what Martin Luther inherited. And if you didn't toe the line and show obedience to the papacy, et cetera, you, and had doctrines different from his, you were executed. Now, in more modern times, we could also point to any a tyrannical dictatorship. In Russia, during the Bolshevik Revolution or Hitler or whatever, if you don't toe the line with the state, right? The state, you're executed. Okay, because religion can be manifested in more than one way. In these belief systems. So that's about the best I can do with those things, but clearly this is a very scary thing, isn't it? So let's go into verse 16 here. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave. Now that's pretty exhaustive, isn't it? That description. To be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, the name of the beast, or its number and its name. Now I'm going to get back to the number in just a little bit. Couple of things here. And we're going to talk about the mark and in contrast to the seal of God in just a minute. But the best I can do from my own personal studies and reading other commentaries, to have a mark on the forehead or seal means that not only that you belong to this person, but affects how you think. You know, whenever I teach you about making the sign of the cross and the history of the making of the sign of the cross, we know initially that they would make the sign of the cross not like this, but on where? The forehead, and then somewhere around the 4th century, and I think this is clouded in stuff that we can't peel away at this point. I don't think it's just me. I don't think anybody knows how we transition from the forehead to the larger making the sign of the cross. But making the sign of the cross on the forehead was on baptism, because we still have this in our baptismal ceremony, right? Right? That you have been, mark you as one, receive the sign of the cross both upon your forehead and upon your heart to mark you as one redeemed by Christ the crucified. And of course, with mind and heart, it means now our mind and heart belong to whom? Christ, and we think that way. So the implication is, with all the Bible stuff and cultural things, that the image of the mark of the beast on the forehead means not only that these people belong to the beast, right, but they what? They think like the beast, and that's why they're going to worship him. They think like the beast. Okay? In other words, let's put it this way. Let's put it in a different, in modern terminology. What we're talking about here are different world views. We've got the worldview of the Bible, which is God, and the worldview of the world. Okay? And those who belong to the beast have a worldview of the world and this coalition. Those who have the seal that we'll get back to in just a minute have a mind. As a matter of fact, for those who know your New Testament spacing, our mind is supposed to be what? Whose mind are we supposed to have? Christ. And what does Paul say when he's talking about the mind, and you need to, I don't want to give it away. We saw it in Ephesians just a little while ago. Our mind is to be what?
Held captive.
Held captive? Yep, that's another one. I'm looking for another word. Renewed. In the renewing of your mind. Matter of fact, one person wrote a book, I think it was the 70s, I forget who it was. But his book was entitled The Battle for the Mind. Because wherever your mind is, that's where your loyalty is going to be, right? Yeah. So anyway, that's the best I can do on that. And then, of course, with the mark on the hand, the implication that has to do with certain rights that you have. If you belong to the beast, you have privileges, right? And you can be involved, and you're going to have prestige and power. You'll be involved with the economy, all those things. You have position. But if you don't have the mark of the beast, you're out. And you won't have all those things. And that has happened historically all throughout the history of the Christian church, right down to our current time. As a matter of fact, talking about the beast, and just give you an example, you may not know this. In the Lutheran church in Europe, in many places, and specifically Sweden, Sweden is a state church. Did you know that? State church. Guess who pays the pastor's salary? The state. Guess where his loyalties are? The state. Okay? And here's my point. The Lutheran Church of Sweden ordains women. Okay, they do that, fine. But if you don't accept that, you can't be a pastor in the Lutheran Church of Sweden. You're what? You're out. Who says so? The state church of Sweden. And we're going to go into more and more of those details later on, because most of you probably don't know all the specifics that can be given in time, in the past, and also today. But we'll try to do that eventually. So anyway, there's advantages. Let me put it differently. There's disadvantages of being a Christian. Now see, we're very blessed in America, aren't we? I think that's one reason we have a hard time totally identifying with this. And I don't want to get too political here. But I think many of us can see, well, how long is this wonderful arrangement we're going to have with Christians going to last in America? Fast forward 50 years. Is it going to be different? Fast forward 100 years. See? So we're very blessed. That's why I think that's one reason we have a hard time understanding Revelation. Because America is somewhat unique in the history of the human race in terms of the religious freedoms that we have. This is not the norm. And really, it's been a pretty small window, hasn't it, historically speaking? So that's why we have a hard time relating to this coalition sometimes when it can be found all throughout the history of the Christian church and even in other parts of the world. I just gave you one little example with the state church of Sweden. But we'll come back to that. Okay, verse 17. So that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is the name of the beast or the number of its name. As if... Let's see, I didn't use the mark of the beast. Let's do that. I forgot to do that. And then we'll move on, both 16 and 17. So let's look at some passages about the mark in contrast to seals and things like that. Go to Revelation chapter 7. How far do I want to read? Well, let's just start at verse 1. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree. Two. Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal. The seal. By the way, consistently in Revelation, those who are belong to God are called, they've been sealed by God. Those who belong to the beast say they have the mark of the beast. So there's a distinction there. The seal of the living God. And he called out with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth or sea or trees until we have sealed. Now you might remember when we talked about this, we said the sealing takes place, well, it fits in with my sermon this morning, through Mother Church, as we bring the gospel to other people, and they're born again and brought into the family of God. They're sealed, aren't they? And baptism. This is evangelism and missions. This is how we're sealed. On their where? Their foreheads. And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe, etc., etc., etc. And we said at that time, we're going to see the 144,000 again in chapter 14, that was a symbolic number symbolizing the totality of all those who are ultimately saved. Okay, and you see how they're sealed. So I won't read the rest of the chapter. I don't think that's necessary. Let's go to Revelation 9:4, though. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now, what's kind of interesting about this, just to bring this to your attention, sort of in the early going of Revelation, we heard a great deal about the non-believer suffering. Do you remember that? Yeah. And that's why we said maybe this has a lot to do with false doctrine and things. We weren't 100% sure. But now as we get deeper into Revelation, what we're hearing more and more about, although we heard it early on too, is that the non-Christians have the upper hand, and it's the Christians who suffer, although we did see that a little bit in earlier in Revelation too. Okay, still with this idea, let's go to other parts of the New Testament. Would you go to 2 Corinthians 1? 2 Corinthians 1, and we'll want verses 21 and 22. It is God who establishes us with you in Christ and has anointed us, verse 22, and who has also put his seal on us and given us his Spirit in our hearts as a guarantee. So the seal is like a guarantee. We belong to God. And if we belong to Jesus, we will also win in the end, won't we, with Jesus. Okay, and then the last one, didn't have the word seal, I don't think, but the concept is there, and that is 2 Timothy 2.19. No, I think it does have the word seal now that I think about it. 2 Timothy 2.19. Let's start at verse 14. The reason I'm doing this, put it in context, because we're not only going to see the idea of seal, but we're going to see it in the context of false teaching, which fits in with Revelation, doesn't it? So let's start with verse 14. 2 Timothy 2.14. Remind them of these things and charge them before God not to quarrel about words. Now, what he means here, he means meaningless quarreling. Some people use that and say, well, we shouldn't fight about doctrine. Well, that's the whole point. Yeah, we are supposed to fight about doctrine. But this is just quibbling over unimportant words is what he means, which does no good but only ruins the hearers. 15, do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker who has no need to be ashamed, rightly handling what? Yeah, that means you may have to argue if it's false doctrine. 16, but avoid irreverent babble, for it will lead people into more and more ungodliness. 17, and their talk will spread like gangrene. That doesn't sound good, does it? Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have swerved from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already happened. This is probably some form of early Gnosticism. They are upsetting the faith of some, verse 19, but God's firm foundation stands, bearing this what? The Lord knows those who are what? His. That's the seal. He knows who are his in the world, in contrast to those who have the mark of the beast. Okay, let's go back to Revelation 13. By the way, for those who are familiar with the terminology, what we're talking about here in terms of the church is the idea of the visible church and the invisible church. The visible church has both believers and unbelievers, believers and hypocrites. And it's in the organized structure of visible church that we find the anti-church, the antichrist, the false teaching and false doctrine. And underneath all that are hidden true believers. True believers. Okay, Revelation 13. Go back. Okay, 13. The name of the beast or the number of its name, 18. This calls for wisdom, but the one who is understanding, calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, a couple of things here. I don't know what you've heard elsewhere, but from my personal studies on my own and reading, I'm of the opinion of two things. You'll never find out precisely an individual man by just going by 666. You just have to trust me. It just doesn't work. And so some people say, well, let's go to the Hebrew. If it was in Hebrew, what would it be? And you even see if you have footnotes, there's even a textual variant there, probably not accurate, but a textual variant that says 616. Now, I'm of the opinion that it should be interpreted a little bit differently, and of course there's many people that say this too, so I'm not unique. It's not like I'm doing something odd. The Greek word there that's translated the number of a man can actually be translated just as reasonably as a human number. In other words, if you take a human number, then it's not pointing to what? One man. Now, let me give you a parallel passage like this, right in Revelation, and I hope this will work. I think it did. Revelation 21:17, I think, and I'll make my point. Revelation 21:17. See if it works in all the translations. Yeah, Revelation 21 said, he also measured its wall, 144 cubits, by what kind of a measurement?
Man.
Exactly the same Greek word. Exactly the same Greek word that's in Revelation 13. So in Revelation 13, they choose to translate it as what? A man's number. And in Revelation 21, they choose to translate it to what? A human number. And that's just the way it is with translation. If you know other languages or whatever, you've got to make judgment calls. So I go with the group that says it's really not referring to a specific man. If you want to go that way, good luck. Because I've studied it, you're not going to find a specific man. There's no number that comes. I don't care what you've read elsewhere. It just doesn't come out that way. But it's a human number. Well, we do have a number, though, don't we? What's the number? 666. Now here, and I'll try to do this, I don't have enough time. I take this, as others do as well, as not trying to figure out an individual man, but this is what's going on here. 666. How many sixes? Did I give you a clue right there? Yeah, I'm going to show you all this. Okay, now, what is the number for perfection, however? Well, three is God. Three, yeah, we got the three. We got the God. What's the what? Seven. Okay. So here we have three sevens, which would be an adequate numerical number to symbolize the one true living God. So I agree with all those commentators who say, rather than doing the fruitless task, which has been proven over and over again, of trying to find a specific man, it's rather what this is saying is that Satan, working through the two agencies, is always trying to be whom? Isn't that what caused Satan's fall in the first place? If we've been through my studies on that in the Garden of Eden? That's the essence of Satan's fall into sin. He wanted to be God. And what did he tempt Adam and Eve to do the moment he showed up in the garden in the form of a snake? That they should be what? Like God. Okay, so I'm with the commentators that say this is most likely a symbolic number. It is a human number. But 666 falls short of God. So he's always trying to be God, which we'll see, but he never really measures up to it. And by the way, what day in the creation account was mankind made? The sixth day. Right? So he again falls short of God. Now, because I'm running out of time, then we'll take questions. Let me do a real quick summary here. I've got here. Show you how in chapter 12 and 13, Satan, through these agencies, is trying to mimic God. And you can write these down if you want. First of all, in chapter 12 and 13, now watch, you'll get the point. Now watch, look up here for a moment. The powers of darkness have been told by expressed by Satan, the first beast, and the second beast. What? That's not coincidental. Okay. Because he wants to set himself as in opposition to God. Okay, so we got three there. And also, the second beast is even described as what? The second beast, what's his image? The second beast. Well, no, but it's right in the text, right? In chapter 13, the second beast is described as what? Speaks like a dragon, but looks like a lamb. Well, who's the lamb? Christ! So here we have another idea of some kind of savior. Hey, look, if we just do such and such and such and such, we can give you a good life. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this religious beast is going to mimic whom? Christ, but be a Christ substitute. And by the way, if you didn't know that, that's what Antichrist means. Many people think that the word Antichrist means against Christ, because that's often the way we use it in English. That's not the primary meaning of the word anti in Greek. Anybody know what I'm going to say? The Antichrist is someone who says they take the place of Christ. Okay, what else we have here? Oh yes, have we been finding through all these verses that the people who don't know the one true living God, they are encouraged to walk the beast? Worship the beast! Right? Worship the beast. Okay? Does this coalition do great signs? Yeah! miracles and all wonder workings and all these things. Okay, and then in verse 15, I told you the Greek word there is actually spirit. You know, well, who the one true living God gives us His spirit, and so the beast also can give his spirit to these things and make them come alive. We've also had the idea of image, which has its parallel with the new, with the real God about image, right? Image of the Creator, image of Christ. And then we had the mark versus the seal, and then this. So it's very clear that this coalition that Satan is using is trying to take the place of the one true living God, Christ, and the one true church. That's what he's trying to do through all these coalitions. Let's conclude with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.